It is December 31st, 1997. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
I'm with Lee Riley in his office at UC Berkeley for his Pew Scholars oral history interview. And I don't have too many follow-up questions. This is basically a continuation of where we left off yesterday. And listening back over the tapes last night, I was really struck by kind of your progression, mm-hmm. or going from a trained clinician, mm-hmm. to a bench scientist. Mm-hmm. Most Pew scholars have this notion of being a bench scientist from a very Maybe early, and they mm-hmm. develop their research programs as a graduate student. Mm-hmm. And then continue as a postdoc, either learning new molecular techniques or refining the program that they started, and that's what mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. continue to do. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that you had started with a basic clinical background, mm-hmm. and as your work has progressed, mm-hmm. you've had to not only adopt and learn the techniques used, mm-hmm. but also the knowledge base. Mm-hmm. of cell physiology, bacterial cell physiology, mm-hmm. Host cell physiology, mm-hmm. biochemistry, mm-hmm. genetics. And how does one amass that amount of information mm-hmm. and synthesize that amount of information? Mm. Or is it more simple than it seems? I mean, it's just...
Well, I think time is definitely a factor that, you know... I've been doing this now for almost, if you include my, I guess, fellowship years, 1984. So it's been about 14 years. That's when all the, sort of the basic sort of molecular biology knowledge pursuit, I guess, got started. And so I guess my approach is that, when I do certain... There's certain things that I want to do that I feel that I have to accomplish in terms of my research questions, which are still really focused on public health. But I don't want to just do conventional public health, and so to get to that the final goal, I sort of try to identify what I need to learn and. What sort of skills I need to develop, and I came to the realization that I really do have to know molecular biology and biochemistry and cell biology to really get to the point where I want to get to, and so I guess my accumulation of these types of knowledge, I think, is more focused, I don't look at all aspects of molecular biology or all aspects of biochemistry. I just pick and choose what I think I need to accomplish what I want to accomplish. So it was a little more streamlined in terms of my accumulation of knowledge in those areas. So, I don't have the in-depth knowledge that I think many of the other more traditional sort of bench scientists may have. So I would always have to go back and look up, some basic stuff. I am able to accomplish what I need to accomplish, at least by just picking and choosing from the knowledge base, and so that may have helped to accelerate this whole process and be able to do it the way I've done it. But, I still feel, when I go to the Pew meetings, I don't feel as secure in my, basic science knowledge base as maybe some of the PhDs, in the group. But what's nice is that, I can really understand, the presentations that these other Pew scholars, make. In these meetings, and it was interesting because I remember the very first meeting I went to, I was totally lost in most of the presentations, the zebrafish and neuronal development stuff. But by the second, third meetings, and fourth meetings, you know, I was able to actually follow them. And so, you know, and I was also very interested in, you know, in those things. I became interested in those things. And then also you recognize that no matter what discipline of, you know, so-called biomedical science you're involved in, there's always some knowledge that you can grab from what other people are doing to the work that you're doing. You know, there's some presentations, I think, by people working on cell signal transduction in cancer, which turns out to have relevance to what I'm doing with my E. coli work, in terms of the way the E. coli triggers cell signal transduction in mammalian cells, and how calcium flux is affected by this interaction. And, you know, apparently this is a big field in cancer.
Right.
And so one of the few scholars, you know, presented his work on that, and then I talked to him about that. And you know, it was so I guess that's at least a recognition that I'm able to, you know, I've learned something,
right.
You know, in these fields, and that I can do it. But as you can see, you know, the only reason I was captured by that was because I'm doing exactly that with E. coli, and so now I can focus on that and go, you know, and you know, sort of look at that in more depth, what's going on in the cancer field. Just that aspect of calcium flux in mammalian cells, and that would be immediately relevant to what I'm doing in my research field. But you know, it's a lot of work. I mean, you know, I spend a lot of time, you know, doing this variety of things, and that's only one aspect of what I do. You know, I have this entire set of field projects going on abroad that I also have to, you know, take care of and run them. And so I'm here every weekend, and, you know, late into the evening, so so that I could, you know, just do all these things.
Okay. And we'll get back to spending your life here in the lab and in the field, mm-hmm. when you have a wife and children.
Mm-hmm.
But to go on a little bit more about this, mm. in terms of, I guess let me ask first, mm. that one, many historians or scholars of science argue that, you know, one of the hallmarks of 20th century science, be it quantum physics, mm-hmm. or molecular biology, mm. is that it has grown increasingly distant from any kind of popular understanding,
mm, mm.
That a layperson couldn't pick up a textbook and read and understand, mm-hmm. and inherently know these, mm. make sense of these questions that are being asked in papers.
Mm-hmm.
And given your own background, mm. in that, it seems to me much of your accumulation of knowledge has, mm. been self-taught. How do you see this issue of this is an insider's world,
mm.
and only only people that are, you know, trained in in kind of apprenticeship from, mm-hmm. their college years on,
mm-hmm.
can understand this information versus, you know, there we can strive towards a more popular understanding, mm. or attempt to make what we do or, mm-hmm. scientists do, mm-hmm. more understandable, mm-hmm. to a lay public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the first question is that I have is, you know, is it important that science be better understood by the lay public? You know, especially the way the science is going now, why is it that the lay public has to really understand that, and You know, I have sort of mixed feelings about that, the answer to that question. I remember, you know, when I was growing up, you know, I used to read books by Isaac Asimov, you know, ABC of Relativity, and there's no spokesman like that right now for, you know, for molecular biology or quantum physics who can really sort of explain, you know, these sciences in the way Isaac Asimov or people like that has been able to do. I mean, you know, I was really elated when I could understand relativity in the way, you know, Asimov explained it. And so I think that's one set of deficiency right now that we, I think, that we have. You know, we don't have someone who can really translate in lay terms, you know, these things in a very amusing or enjoyable way. And so, so I think a lot of the kids are not exposed to this as well as they could be. So to answer my first question, I think, yeah, it is important that these things be translated. You know, to get you know, young people excited about science. You know, I certainly, you know, I think I told you yesterday, you know, I was interested in physics, and I think those kind of books that I read early on, you know, really influenced my my interest in going into physics, and, you know, sort of theoretical physics, you know, that sort of thing. In terms of sort of more practical, I guess, need for a lay public to understand this, yeah, I think if this kind of knowledge could be better understood by the public, maybe, you know, that would enhance you know, funding opportunities, you know, by having public support for funding for research. If the lay public could really understand what their tax dollars are being used for, you know, maybe there would be more support from the public. And I think by making it obscure to the lay public, it's going to make it difficult to get the public support, you know, to do this kind of work. So that may be another sort of rationale for you know, at least making it, or at least to satisfy the need to make science understandable for the public. So that doesn't answer your question directly, but I think we have to first answer, you know, you know, the need for doing this, and I guess once that's recognized, then I guess to answer your question, you know, I think that's true with anything right now, because just the information, you know, the field is just exploding. And to really translate, you know, the cell's mass accumulation of information to the lay public in a really understandable way is much more complex than I think it used to be. So, you know, you need you need some sort of spokesman. You know, I think some of these science writers, you know, in newspapers are beginning to fill, you know, that type of role. You know, there are also these popular books that are coming out. Maybe, you know, but they're more sensationalism, you know, the kind of, they're not really trying to explain the science. They're more sort of a, although, you know, there are some really good science writers that I think that do a really good job in, you know, explaining what's going on. Public, so it's also the I think that, you know, the problem, not a problem, but there's also a change in the way information is disseminated now. You know, in, when we were growing up, you know, it was usually the books, but now you have all these other media, you know, of communicating information, and you know, we talk about newspapers where there's really good science writing. You know, that really goes reaches out to a limited audience. You know, it doesn't go into the real mass circulation. And so even, I guess, because of these changes in dissemination, the modes of dissemination of knowledge, there's also still a limited, I think, dissemination of the knowledge. You know, you have to, if you're going to have access through the internet and information, you know, you have to have a computer. And again, that limits to a certain, you know, group of people. you know, and then the way that the information is communicated by television is just very small, you know, segment, you know, of information that, unless you're really into, you know, programs that are shown in PBS or in Discovery Channel or things like that, so, you know, you don't really get the detailed information, so. But I think the opportunities exist, you know, for the same reason, because there's so many different ways of communicating the information that.
What is it about your work that makes it obscure? Is it inherently obscure? Is molecular biology inherently obscure?
I don't think it's inherently obscure. I think it's just complex. To understand, you know, the information that, versus what we currently have, is based on a lot of other background information. And so, to understand what's going on now, you have to understand, you know, other steps that came to this process. And I think that's what makes it complicated. But the final knowledge itself is not that obscure. Just that you have to have the background information to sort of really understand it. And so it's the complexity. So if you can break down the complexity into individual parts, then I think, you know, people can understand it better. No, even the concept of PCR, and that's a good example, because PCR is a very simple technique, very elegant, simple technique. But to really understand it, you have to have knowledge about how polymerase works, even what a DNA is, how DNA is affected by temperature in terms of its you know, association with, you know, the two strands. And that's you know, that's not a high school, you know,
right,
just typical high school knowledge. I mean, maybe in advanced high school, you know, biology might get the kind of information, but it takes a certain level of education, I guess, and, you know, understanding of the background. And, you know, there are people making attempts to sort of simplify or demystify, you know, these new technologies. And I think, you know, I told you about Eva Harris yesterday, who is writing a book, you know, on making PCR technology accessible so that it could be used in developing countries, it could be used in high schools here, and try to really make the technology more understandable, and, you know, why you do certain things, why, you know, why you do certain we use certain reagents to certain things. And so I think it's just beginning to happen. It hasn't quite happened yet.
Yeah.
But somebody has to take the effort to make things less obscure.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your own professionalization, in terms of and having your work accepted to different audiences, going from, say, a CDC bureaucrat to somebody publishing in Science and the Journal of Experimental Biology, the kind of the core basic science journals. How was your reception to kind of an increasingly more basic audience as your work progressed?
I think the people think they're two Lee Rileys.
Okay.
Yeah, people ask me if I'm the same Riley that did the original E. coli work, and then published the thing on TV and Science. So. I deal with two different groups, anyways.
Okay.
So, those two groups haven't really themselves merged. There are a few, who are doing those things too, but so it hasn't been an issue. I present my basic science work to the basic scientists, the Pew group. I present my E. coli work. But for the public health, the epidemiology group, I present my epidemiology work, and they recognize me for that work. There's a paper that I did that tries to fuse the two, which is the one where we looked at, the C strain from New York City, and we found that this was resistant to nitric oxide. There, I was trying to introduce, to bridge the two together. So that paper plus the JX Med paper really are the, sort of the seminal two papers that I think show that these two things have to be linked. And I'm just hoping that, that this approach can be recognized by both groups. And I think there's some, appreciation, I think, of the approach by members of, both groups. That traditionally people, thought that pathogenesis work has to be done at the bench, but there are people beginning to realize how important epidemiology is for pathogenesis. And in fact, I get, postdoc applicants because of that approach. That's what they want to do. This is the way they want to approach pathogenesis questions. And the people who want to go into epidemiology who also want to learn the basic laboratory techniques so that they can apply the techniques to really get further into understanding the epidemiology of infectious diseases. And I get a lot of, postdoc applicants because they want to do that. So the discipline is finally beginning to be recognized, and this is what I wanted to do. And this is why I came to the School of Public Health, to really force that discipline as a new discipline. And so it's beginning to, I think, happen. But there's just not very many people doing that yet. But I don't know, there's also the risk of being labeled as a dilettante, that I'm doing too many different things.
Right.
Not doing anything in depth. Each one. But I think the work itself will speak for itself, right? Hopefully.
Yeah.
So.
And what are the advantages and disadvantages of being considered a dilettante?
Well, you may not be taken serious. So when you publish something, this is something that other people can reproduce, but that it's important. Other people see it as being important, or I don't know if there's any advantage of being called a dilettante. The disadvantage, is the potential for having your work not being taken seriously. It hasn't happened yet, but.
And how does one establish the necessary credentials, quote unquote, and the necessary context to be able to be invited to the right conferences, to have the inside track on when your articles, your papers are being reviewed at journals of the top tier journals, or your grants are being reviewed by study section at NIH.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think you have to consciously make those efforts to assure those things. I think it just happens. Excuse me. I think you sort of recognize that those things are going on when it starts happening. I've never made any sort of conscious effort to put myself in a situation that my work is recognized. I think it just happens if, you know, you get published and you know, if the work is novel enough or you know, important enough. You know, I'm a member of the study section, you know, and obviously to be invited to, you know, become a member, you know, you have to have some expertise in some field. You know, I get invited to the major meetings. In fact, you know, the only time I now go to meetings is if I get invited. I don't, you know. You know, what's pleasing is when, like when you have multiple kind of affirmation from different, you know, unrelated sources of your work. So when I got my first grant from NIH on this TB pathogenesis work, you know, it actually, I was awarded the grant before our science paper came out. So it was done independent of the science paper. You know, the science paper didn't influence the reviewers. And then the science paper came out. So there were two totally independent, you know, affirmation of that piece of work. And, you know, that's very satisfying. That. That, you know, that's a real, it's real. I mean, you need that kind of reassurance, you know, that what you're doing is real, that it's not something important just because I think it's important. You know, you're so subjectively involved in your work that, of course, you're going to consider your work to be important, but, you know, how is it objectively evaluated? And so when something like that happens, then you sort of have an outside confirmation of the importance of the work. And this happens, you know, all the time. Sometimes, maybe not immediately either. Like the discovery that this new E. coli is the cause of, you know, hemorrhagic colitis. You know, that took several years before it was really recognized as a real thing. And now, you know, it's a major public health problem in the U.S. Which is a kind of a ironical way to have that work recognized as being important. It's a major public health problem. You know, it was recognized the other way around, it would have been okay too, that the problem was solved. But no, why it's important now is because it's a major public health problem. And that we're the first ones to describe this illness and discover the E. coli. You know, I guess some people try to make conscious efforts to get themselves into the right situation to be recognized, but, you know, I don't feel that that's satisfying when you have to do it that way to get the recognition. You know, if your work speaks for itself and then it gets recognized, that's much more satisfying than, you know, playing the game, you know, going to the right meetings, meeting the right people. Yeah, no, I just don't like to do it that way.
Mm. Okay. And you had mentioned just a few minutes before about there's these two groups, mm-hmm. That you kind of talk to, and there's these two Lee Rileys.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly it seems to me that, and you mentioned going to the Pew annual meetings, mm-hmm. and, you know, not always feeling like, you know, listening to these talks, mm-hmm. you can understand them, but clearly there's other things you can't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you see yourself as an insider or an outsider to these different groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. I still feel a lot more comfortable with the epidemiology, you know, group. I consider myself an epidemiologist more than a, you know, molecular biologist.
Okay.
But I do feel comfortable with you know, the pathogenesis people, you know, molecular bacteria pathogenesis people, I have no discomfort, you know, discussing in depth, you know, about bacteria pathogenesis work. In fact, that's what I do in the study section. You know, I'm sort of the bacteria pathogenesis expert of the group, in one of the, you know, the bacteria pathogenesis people focused on mycobacterial pathogenesis. So I review those grants. E. coli as well, I feel very comfortable in the study section. So, but, you know, I think Pew Scholars Group is a little different. I think that's even further removed, even mm-hmm. from the type of people who are in the study section. You know, study section is enough MD representation. Okay. And even the PhDs do work that are more or less clinically related, you know. Or at least their basic science may still relate to a pathogen of clinical importance. You know, the work itself may have nothing to do with pathogenesis or anything, but it still relates to a pathogen that's of clinical importance. So, and you know, that comes up in our study section meetings. You know, if someone's working on a sigma factor for a non-pathogenic organism, you know, that's not going to be looked upon very favorably, no matter how good the science is. But if it's somebody's working on a sigma factor of a very important pathogen, that will be looked upon favorably. And so, you know, there is that difference. They could be working on the same sort of mechanisms, but one happens to be a pathogen, the other not. Then, of course, the one that's working on the pathogen is going to be better evaluated. And so, but the Pew group, you know, when you start talking about zebrafish neuronal development, things like that, now that's, yeah, I don't feel comfortable, you know, with that sort of aspect of molecular biology. But then neither would, you know, someone working on, you know, the same peer group, someone working on, cell signal transduction. You know, that person may not be comfortable talking about people working in development and neuronal development, you know. And so, and what's nice about the peer group is that, you know, people come up to me when it has something to do with, you know, clinical, you know, questions, you know, about the disease that may relate to the work that they're doing. And in fact, you know, I mean, in dinner time conversations, they'd rather talk about the kind of thing I'm doing than what they're doing, because, you know, it's an infectious disease problem. You know, we're actually, when I was talking about the E. coli work, you know, these meetings are held in Mexico or Costa Rica, places like that, where you can get infected with this E. coli. So they ask me, you know, is it okay to eat this or that? Yeah. And I can go into those things. It's fun. So.
And what did you say to them?
Yeah, so you can get infected. In fact, that's how I presented it in my last talk. You know, you have to give a talk in the first year and then last year.
Right.
And I said, you know, 15% of you in this audience are going to develop some sort of diarrhea before the end of the conference. And, you know, based on what we know about endotoxic E. coli in Mexico. Mm. And, so, you know, I mean, they like that.
Only scientists could like that. Oh, man, this is really cool. I'm going to get diarrhea. Yeah. Okay. And why do you think you were chosen a Pew Scholar?
I don't know. I mean, I submitted my work. I was nominated by, you know, Cornell University.
Right.
And so Cornell, I guess at that level, Cornell itself recognized that work was interesting enough to nominate me. And then... I was surprised that I was selected, you know, in the final group, because they're not very MDs to begin with.
Right.
And in fact, I'm the first and the only MD from Cornell to ever, I think, have received a Pew. You know, all the others have been PhDs. I don't know last year, but I don't think anybody from Cornell got selected. But you know, up to that point, and even after that, it's always been PhDs. So I'm certainly the only one from the Department of Medicine that's ever gotten a Pew. And so. So you know, it was a nice recognition of that work. I think also it was the fact that I was very lucky to have actually been in Cornell, because nobody else was doing bacterial pathogenesis. I filled a real big gap there. Mm-hmm. See, Cornell and Rockefeller has this, you know, and every institution has a tradition,
yeah,
influenced by some big figures,
right.
And so they've always been on the cell biology side, you know. If they were doing any infectious disease work at all, it was really cell biology, the host site. And so for me, it was great, because I could go to Cornell and learn and work with these people who were working on the host side of the host-parasite relationship. And so I could gain all the knowledge from them. But then contribute to the work that I was doing. So it was just a perfect match for me. And then yet I was filling a gap that they didn't have. So what I was doing is completely novel to them. It wasn't novel if I went to Stanford or, you know, Harvard or you know, some of the other places where they're doing a lot of really good bacteria pathogens and so on. But at Cornell, it was new. So maybe that, you know, I was, again, in the right place at the right time. And so it's not just the science, I mean, obviously.
Okay. Okay, well, to talk about the serendipity factor and the many Peace Scholars talk about, let's go back a little bit and figure out how you ended up at Cornell. So we'll bring up these kind of broader issues again, but to go back the chronology a little bit, I wanted to ask, you know, after your tenure at the CDC and getting the clinical specialty, the extra year that you did, was it necessary to do a postdoc?
Why did I decide to do postdocs? Well, the main reason was I wanted to learn more molecular biology, you know, techniques. No, it wasn't necessary. I mean, I had the option to stay at CDC. You know, they wanted me to stay, actually. But, well, one other reason was not staying at CDC was more of a personal reason, family reason. You know, Jesse, my wife, didn't like Atlanta at all. She was from New York City, and, you know, at that time in Atlanta, these things were still backward. And so she didn't like Atlanta at all. And so we couldn't stay in Atlanta. So it was either that, you know, and you know, I could have gone to WHO, you know, if I wanted to. I could have tried to, you know, make the arrangement to do that. But I wanted to learn more molecular biology work and do more molecular biology. But even then, I wasn't thinking of an academic career. You know, I wanted to be involved in some sort of public health institution, someplace to, you know, apply the sort of the molecular techniques to do this new molecular epidemiology work. And I still wanted to go abroad at that point, too. So as I was leaving CDC, I specifically asked them, if anything ever comes up in India, let me know. And so they kept in touch with me throughout my fellowship, and whenever something came up, they would, you know, send me the information. And I think it was in my second year of my fellowship, they announced, you know, this new program in India. So I said I was very interested. So that's how I did it. But no, you know, basically I wanted to go to Stanford to, you know, have the opportunity to work with Stan Falco.
Right, and which you don't.
Which I didn't, because Stan already had all these people on the wait list, and Stan sort of referred me to Gary Skulnick.
Okay.
Which turned out to be fine, because I still got to work with Stan Falco's group. They were upstairs from us. And in fact, you know, I think I learned a lot more from Stan Falco's group, you know, than I did in Gary Skulnick's lab, in terms of, you know, just the approaches to pathogenesis and things. And but, you know, of course, I learned a lot from Gary in sort of the general approaches to doing science and being a bench scientist. And, you know, he was very, very generous in providing the opportunities, you know, for me to be able to do that. Because I essentially came with my E. coli strains, and, you know, I had this idea that I wanted to work on, and essentially Gary provided all the facilities to be, you know, for me to be able to do it. Yeah. And he supported the project itself, and it turned out to, you know, be very interesting. And eventually, you know, it led to another science paper, which, you know, was done by Gary's group after I had left. But it was based on the E. coli, you know, that I brought to Gary's lab. So, so, you know, it actually led to somebody else being able to, you know, have a real nice, you know, piece of work come out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I didn't think that, you know, I would really heavily get into pathogenesis until maybe, you know, I really got interested in the process towards the end of my first year of my fellowship. So.
And what kind of mentor was Skulnick?
He was a very good mentor. You know, he was very knowledgeable, very generous with his time, and you know, and also just the resources. You know, being I think he was an editor of JCM, not JCM. JCI, Journal of Clinical Investigations, that he had an opportunity to review many papers and things, so he was able to communicate what was going on in the field to all of us, and that was very, very helpful. He also, you know, was interested in international health. Mm-hmm. We call it geographic medicine. And in fact, we started the geographic medicine program at Stanford together. I went to Mexico and started this field site for the division, and you know, it's continues to operate. And you know, Gary eventually became the chief of the combined geographic medicine infectious disease division. But you know, we did that together.
Yeah.
And you know, I was very impressed when we were just getting started how he used his own personal money to buy all the supplies and the van. To work in the field, you know, it was his retirement money from he transferred from VA to Stanford and got this retirement money from VA, and he just put that into the project. And that's when I really recognized that Gary was really committed to this whole thing. And, you know, so that's when I really committed myself to really get the field projects going. And you know, we had several papers come out of that work, and so it was a lot of fun. So. Even then, I was still doing these field work, you know, mm-hmm. in addition to just trying to get the basic science work done. Gary is a very, very supportive
was Falco's
preceptor.
Falco's group doing a lot of field work?
Or no, they were really basic pathogenesis, molecular bacteria, but yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I think there were people in Falco's group interested in, you know, pathogens. There was a woman named Pam Small who used to be an anthropologist and worked in India for 4 years mm-hmm. before she decided to become a graduate student in microbiology and then eventually became a Stan Falco's fellow. And you know, we're still very close friends. She's also in the study section, my study section. And, you know, she's someone who really has this interest, but she's not doing, you know, real basic, you know, pathogenesis work. So, there were a couple others, you know, interested in field work, I think, or at least recognized the importance of field work. And Stan Falco himself recognizes the importance of, you know, field work. Just that he's not, you know, trained to do that. His wife, Lucy Tompkins, you know, is a hospital infection disease person and, you know, applies a lot of the molecular techniques to know, study hospital infections. And in fact, she was probably one of the first ones to apply molecular techniques to do nosocomial infection, you know, work and the staff, methicillin-resistant staff, you know, when she was in Seattle. And so it was a really good group. I mean, they're just really, you know, great sets of faculty, I think, at Stanford that, you know, really helped me to crystallize what I wanted to do, in, at least on the molecular biology side.
Right. Okay.
There were certain people who really, you know, really had to be there at the right time for me to have been able to do what I'm doing now. So, and those, you know, include people like Gary Skolnick and Stan Falco, Lucy Tompkins. And, I'm trying to think about it. No, there's another person, Harry Greenberg, who was a gastroenterology person doing rotavirus pathogenesis work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I got to know them really close. We're still, you know, friends, and you know, we communicate, and CDC too. You know, so my chief, you know, Paul Blake, is very, very, you know, important, and Mitch Cohen, who brought the molecular techniques, you know, to CDC, and for us to get going. And Roger Feldman was another very important mentor. In fact, Roger Feldman and I worked in India together after my fellowship. So. Those were sort of the big mentors I think I had.
And why geographical medicine? Why the name geographical?
I don't know why that Gary came up with that name. Okay. I mean, I was always saying international health, but I don't know. I don't know why he came up with that term. You know, I think there were other universities that already had such programs, like Tufts. Uh-huh. Their program was called geographic medicine. Mm-hmm. I think there's one in Case Western, too.
Okay.
It's called Geographic Medicine. So I think Gary wanted to use the same.
Yeah.
Whereas Cornell is called International Medicine.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
and what is the role of serendipity in making a creative and innovative or risk-taking scientist, biomedical researcher?
What is the serendipity involved?
Yeah, what is the role of serendipity?
Oh, I think there's lots. I mean, I think they're very important. If I didn't go to New York City at the time when TB was rising, I don't think I would have the grant to do the work that I'm doing. I don't think I would have even done the work that I did. I don't think I would have even come up with this concept that resistance to nitric oxide is a very important, you know, pathogenic mechanism for TB. And the only reason I was interested in Cornell was because they had field projects in Brazil. There's nothing to do with TB. I wanted to be in New York City, and I was interested in Cornell because they had field projects in Brazil, and Warren Johnson, you know, was a very sincere, interested, investigator doing work in Brazil. And I had another friend, John Ho, who I've known since residency. He also went to CDC, and he's been pushing me to come to Cornell. And that was the only reason I went to Cornell. It had nothing to do with the interest in pathogenesis. You know, Cornell wasn't even doing pathogenesis. It was the wrong place to be if I wanted to, you know, have a critical mass of people to work with.
Okay, let me flip this over.